Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
For joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. U.S. military veterans say the newest additions to their ranks have somewhat different needs from those of the past. Joining me to talk about veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, William Boettcher. He's past national commander of AMVETS. He was co-chair of the National Symposium for the Needs of Young Veterans. Good morning to you, Bill. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show.
Rick Mays is staff writer for the Times News Service. Good morning to you, Rick. Patrick Campbell is a sergeant in the D.C. National Guard who served as a combat medic in Iraq. Good morning to you.
It is so good to be here.
Thank you. And Shoshana Johnson. She's a retired specialist from the U.S. Army. During her service in Iraq, she became America's first black female prisoner of war. Good morning to you, Shoshana. Welcome.
Good morning, ma'am.
And throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Bill Boettcher, there was a recent symposium put on by AMVETS to focus on younger veterans. Why was that necessary?
About 6 years ago, AMVETS, as one of the leading veteran service organizations in America, started to take a look at what our membership was, what we were doing to keep true to one of our basic principles, and that's to advocate and help veterans get their entitlements and benefits. And we noticed, along with some of the other major groups, that we just weren't touching the younger veterans for some reason. We noticed that lifestyles have changed. The whole makeup of our military has changed, especially in regards to the Guard and Reserve units that make up such a big part of our defense effort today and our war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we thought it was imperative that we get in touch with these young veterans, see if our country and we as a veteran service organization are meeting the needs. So we decided to put on a symposium. Took a couple of years in the making to do. And in Chicago, we had probably the first good look at veterans' benefits in over 50 years.
How many people were there?
We had close to 1,000. That's facilitators. There was employment folks there, some exhibitors, and veterans. We touched every segment of society, legislators, employment people, educators, and, of course, our veterans.
William Boettcher, he's co-chair of the National Symposium for the Needs of Young Veterans. Rick Mays, in what ways do you see younger vets having different problems from those who preceded them? How are they special or worthy of special focus?
Well, the needs of younger veterans, the ones particularly coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan, are different than the needs of the older Vietnam era, World War II, Korean War veterans, simply because they're looking more immediately at transitioning back to civilian life, no matter what it is that happened to them. So their primary concerns when they're looking for something are employment and education. They want to get back into civilian life as quickly as they can. They want to pick up in their life exactly where they were before they served. And that's a little different than somebody who's been out of the service for a while and has already made that adjustment.
How difficult are those issues for them?
For some of them, it's very hard. It really depends on what you were doing in the military, how long you were there, and what kind of disruption you have. I think that, and did you come out with the service with a disability or not? All of those things can play in your ability to get a job, your ability to get an education, and really your ability to return to the civilian life you had before you served in the military.
Rick May is, he's a Times News Service staff writer. Shoshana Johnson, you're a second-generation U.S. Army veteran. How was your service different from that of your father's from the very beginning?
I don't think it was that much different. My dad actually was exiting just as I was going in. So we served really right about the same kind of same time. Of course, I have definitely different needs than he did being a female. This is the first time that the U.S. military has seen the amount of females in active combat. And we really have to address their needs as we come home. They aren't noticing our issues with PTSD as quickly.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Really, because they haven't seen it in the amount of women, this amount of women before. And also, you have to deal with the natural things that comes along with being a woman. A lot of us are coming home and we're having children and, you know, basically continuing life. And how's the VA system going to help us deal with that? Not just the medical part of it, but the mental part of it also.
You never sought out a combat-related position.
Oh, definitely not. It was not something that I was actively pursuing at all. Being from a military family and being a cook in the military is not something I thought I would see.
Shoshana Johnson, retired specialist from the U.S. Army. Turning to you now, Patrick Campbell, you're a member of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Talk about why there was a need for such a group.
Well, when in 2003, when soldiers started coming home and telling the stories about what was happening to them in Iraq, there were some pretty disturbing trends. People were fighting without the tools they needed to succeed. People didn't have body armor. People were driving around in soft-skinned Humvees. Now, I want you to imagine driving around, you know, places where there are homemade bombs on the side of the road with all that's keeping between you and the bomb is some cloth. And you know, you're talking to the U.S. military, which is the most powerful military in the world, not giving the tools they needed to their soldiers was just ridiculous. So we were formed to give those soldiers a voice, to give them an opportunity to tell everyone. I mean, I'm really glad what AMVETS did in Chicago in October, because it was one of the few times any other organization has really sat down and said, we need to listen to the veterans, and especially the veterans of this generation, and say, what do you need? And our organization just gives people an opportunity to tell their story.
And who's listening to their stories?
Everyone. I mean,
are people in government listening to their stories?
Right before everyone departed for the elections, they had a series of congressional panels. I was able to testify at two or three of them about the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't feel as though I have the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, but I definitely have some symptoms. I mean, whenever I get stressed out, I still have nightmares. And I have some memories that I'm not really ready to deal with. And I've been having the opportunity to tell those stories to people, because with only 1% of the country serving in the United States military and having to take the brunt of the wars that we're fighting, people just don't know what life is like there.
Explain what life is like there.
Well, I mean, Shoshana can answer this too, but it's hot. It's boring. And then it's really scary.
Well, I can't say unfortunately, but I was captured 3 days into the conflict. My time in Iraq was actually very short. It was spent mostly in captivity.
How did that happen, Shoshana? Explain to us.
It was within the first couple of days of the war, my unit was ambushed in Nazariya, Iraq. 11 people lost their lives, and it was 6 of us that was captured, including Jessica Lynch. 5 of us were taken to Baghdad. Lynch was kept in the hospital in Nazariya. And then 2 pilots were shot down later that evening that joined the 507th prisoners of war. I really spent my entire time in Iraq in captivity. You know, it wasn't pleasant, but it was better than I ever expected.
How so?
I was not tortured, you know, and which is something that automatically comes to mind. And that's something that every soldier, every member of the armed forces within Iraq and Afghanistan worries about when they go on patrol.
However, you were shot in the ankles.
During the ambush.
During the ambush. And then you were operated on while
Correct.
You were held in captivity.
Saved my legs.
Was that something that they asked you about or said, we are doing?
They actually made me sign a release.
I signed a release,
and I could have refused, but under the circumstances, I think that would have been silly.
So you went under
general anesthesia.
For how long?
I have no idea.
Did you have fears about doing that?
Definitely. U.S. was bombing at the time. The hospital was shaking from the U.S. bombings. But I am grateful for the treatment I received. But like I said, you know, every U.S. service member is worried about being me, being captured in Iraq or Afghanistan. And that's a situation that's hard to do. You're doing your job and you're worried about being taken prisoner. And then after all of that's done, you come home to quote-unquote regular life. How do you adjust?
Patrick, how do you adjust?
I mean, the fight really begins when you get home. I mean, I came home, I kissed the ground. I was like, I didn't get any of my legs blown off. All my guys came home alive. And I thought, all right, I can just let go. I don't have to have any of the stress. But the sad part was I stopped trying to keep myself together. And then everything went bad. I lost friends because I was irritable. I said things I didn't mean. I started doing things that were so uncharacteristic of myself. And the people who were my closest friends when I was overseas now don't talk to me. And I became a completely different person when I got home because I forgot. I didn't take the warnings that I had received saying the fight really begins the day you land. Because you're trained to be shot at. You're trained to be taken prisoner. No one's ever ready for it, but that's what they train you for. But there's the very little training on. You get like a 2-hour video saying, please don't beat up your wife, you know, when you get home. And you come home and you want everything to be right. And they don't even, you do this screening. And when I got home, they gave me this list and they said, answer this questionnaire. Answer it honestly, but if you answer yes to any of these questions, everyone else is going to go home and you're going to stay. So do you think anyone answered yes to that question? Of course not.
Patrick Campbell, sergeant in the D.C. National Guard. He served as a combat medic in Iraq. Do join us, 800-433-8850. After a short break, we'll be right back. And we're back talking about how younger veterans of the Afghanistan and Iraq war are handling some of the problems they're facing now. Joining us now is Lonnie Moore, medically retired as an Army captain, president of the board of directors of the Wounded Warrior Project. Good morning to you, Lonnie.
Good morning. Thank you for having us on.
Certainly. Talk about what your responsibilities were during your service in Iraq.
When I was in Iraq, I was an infantry platoon leader. Approximately, I had 40 guys under me and 4 Bradley fighting vehicles. We basically ran everyday patrols, raids, trained Iraqi police, presence patrols. We guarding our own base. I mean, we had several missions, helped to assist the locals in booming their economy. We had a lot of stuff going on.
And what happened in April of 2004 that brought you home?
In April of 2004, there was an uprising in western Iraq, started with Al-Sadr. On our way to assist some Marines that were being pinned down in Ramadi, Iraq, a rocket-propelled grenade pierced the turret of my Bradley and necessitated the amputation of my right leg above the knee.
So you spent a year and a half at Walter Reed?
Yes, I spent a year and a half at Walter Reed where I did my rehab.
And talk about how this Wounded Warrior Project helped you.
You know, it's very interesting. It started the second day I was there. A gentleman walked in and said, "Hey, I've got a backpack for you. Just want to say thank you." Opened the backpack, and it had a sweat, shaving kit, CD player, you know, just some stuff to make me comfortable until my family got there. And I met with a gentleman later who happened to be John Melia, who is the founder of the Wounded Warrior Project, and I become involved, and it's grown into something much more. But just that backpack was nice to get me through the first few days.
So now are you doing the same thing? Are you visiting with wounded at Walter Reed?
Yes, I do occasionally. We also have a lot of events that we put on where I talk to a lot of the men and women coming home. There are people there for me, a lot of Vietnam veterans. They come in and they mentored us. When you're laying there in the hospital bed and you're missing your leg, you really don't know what's going to happen the rest of your life. And they're there to tell you that whatever you want to happen is going to happen. You're no different than you were before.
I gather you lobbied for and won passage of a measure creating military insurance for traumatic injury.
Correct. One of the guys that was wounded in Iraq, Ryan Kelly, had a vision for a write-in similar to a civilian write-in for a traumatic injury, loss of leg, brain injury, etc., to have $25,000 to $100,000 provided you to get you through the first initial few months or years after your injury. We lobbied on Congress along with Senator Craig, who is a big supporter of us. And it went through, and amazingly, about 2 weeks' time.
And, you know, all through this, as I'm listening to this conversation from our guests in the studio and from you as well, I'm wondering about the Veterans Administration itself and to what extent it has been active in meeting the needs of veterans like yourself.
That's a very good question. We actually work closely with the VA, and the VA actually has symposiums at Walter Reed, Balboa Naval Medical Center, around the country, asking what is good and what's bad, and they've actually created a seamless transition program. As you transition out of the military, they transition you into the VA, which is different than it was in the past. You actually had to get out first before you could become enrolled in the VA. And the VA, while it has its misgivings, is they've taken a huge step into improving it to meet the needs of my generation.
And at this point, what do you think could be done by this country in general to better meet the needs of veterans like yourself?
Well, the biggest thing you can do is walk up to a veteran, shake their hand, and say thank you. That means the world to us. But unfortunately, that doesn't take care of everything. The government doesn't have a endless budget, and we at WWP, we survive on people's generosity, and a hope and prayer goes a long way, but sometimes so does a dollar. So, you know, dedicating money to help organizations that are fulfilling the needs of the wounded veteran and the non-wounded veteran. There are many injuries you can't see, post-traumatic stress disorder, head injuries. You know, there's approximately 500 amputees and probably 2,000 mild to serious traumatic brain injuries, and you don't see those often.
Lonnie, just generally speaking, how are you doing?
Oh, I am doing fantastic. I'm engaged to a wonderful woman who I'm marrying next March. I work for a great company in the D.C. area, FNHUSA. We provide small arms weapons to the military, and I really have nothing to complain about in life. I have a great job as a president of the board of directors for the Wounded Warrior Project, and I get to go out and mentor and you know, hang out with the people still coming home.
I'm so glad you have such a positive outlook. I congratulate you on your forthcoming marriage and hope all goes well.
Thank you.
Lonnie Moore, he's medically retired as an Army captain, president of the Board of Directors of the Wounded Warrior Project. Thanks again. And turning to you now, Rick Mays, what's the broader picture here? How many people are coming home with stories like Shoshana's or everybody you've heard from?
Well, it really depends. It depends on your circumstances of where you're coming home to. If you're an active duty member and you're returning from combat without a disability and you're able to go back to your unit and go back to your life that you had before as a full-time active duty military person, I think that the transition mostly is fine this is what you joined the military for and this is what you expect. I think it's entirely different if you're disabled or you choose to leave the military because you've had enough of it, or if you're a National Guard and Reserve member who got called up for a year or 2 years of assignment and have to go back and make that transition without a military community to support you. I think that for those people, the seamless transition is mostly just one on paper, that it's not one that they're really that's ready at this point to help you. I think that one day you're shown the door and said, good luck, and that if you don't know who to call for help, you can't get the help. If you just really need to know a lot more than I think that you have available to you. I think that what Lonnie said about a dollar would go a long ways probably is true, but I'm not sure that it takes a lot more money. I just think it's a matter of where the money's being spent and how it's being spent. I'm not sure that the transition assistance that the military is providing to people are really giving them exactly what it is that they need in order to adjust to life, in order to prepare themselves.
What are you saying that you think they need, for example, as far as PTSD is concerned?
I think that there's no amount of counseling that's enough for people that are coming back out of combat. I think that that the VA or DOD or some outside organization, I don't think it really matters who it is, needs to keep following up with people for 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months after they've left, because people aren't going to volunteer necessarily that they're having mental health problems. They're going to probably try to hide them. They're probably going to try to get by in life as well as they can. And only when something goes terribly wrong are they going to be the one to go seek help. And that's, I think, the kind of thing that's needed.
Bill Betcher, isn't that what we purportedly learned from Vietnam?
Exactly. 35 to 40 years ago, when I and my brothers and sisters came home from Vietnam, PTSD wasn't even recognized as a disorder by the medical community. We're fortunate in one way that it is recognized today, and that there are attempts to work with our returning veterans to deal with this.
Well, what the problem?
But the problems are, is number one, the stigma attached. If you have Patrick, you know, as you said, who's going to answer a questionnaire positive if they know they're not going to get to come home? That discourages folks from dealing.
Well, I'm not sure I'm clear about what that question might be.
It's a screening. They give you, when you get home, it's called a post-deployment health assessment.
Okay.
And they're asking you questions about, do you have nightmares? Do you swerve on when you see things on the side of the
road?
Okay. Now, all of us, my unit, would have said yes to every one of those questions. But because if we answered yes, we would have had to have mandatory counseling before we could be released.
And you didn't want that?
No one wanted that. I
mean, why?
Because we all wanted to go see our families. We had been away from our families for a year and a half.
I see. You're saying it would have required your staying where you were longer.
Until you were healed.
Correct.
And everyone could take years.
And exactly. Everyone in your unit is going to know that you were the one that stayed behind because you have mental problems.
Right.
Because you've reported mental problems. That's part of the stigma.
Oh, sure.
Is that everyone's going to know that it was you.
How did this get into place?
Well, it was an attempt to address PTSD.
Okay.
And, there are many of my brothers and sisters from Vietnam War that to this day are not receiving treatment and don't even know they've got it. They're still suffering but don't know. This was, very honest, upfront attempt to try to alleviate that. But, again, with not only that problem, you've got unit commanders. You've got folks that may have wanted to make a career of the military, and they're a little skeptical about admitting that they have any kinds of these symptoms because they're afraid that it will affect their military career. PTSD requires, one, it needs to be diagnosed. It needs to have constant attention, not just for a couple of weeks. It has to be followed up on for years and years and years and years. It can be treated successfully.
Outwardly, Patrick, Shoshana, you both look like such strong, healthy individuals. What does it feel like inside, Shoshana?
Sometimes it feels like there's a war going on within you. You want to return to that person that you were before, that your family loved and, supported. Not like that really is, like they don't now, but you're a different person, and sometimes it's hard to express that in a way. There's a lot of guilt because I came home and some didn't, and how do you live with the fact that you're walking this earth and you can't explain why someone else's child is not here?
Did you see those around you being killed?
I saw some that didn't make it. I did not see a lot. I think the males in my group saw a lot more than I did. But it's hard. And if it wasn't for my family members who have served in conflicts before me, and I have a RN who's in the Gulf War and a psychiatric nurse who pushed for me to get treatment, I'd still be walking around in a fog.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Patrick, what about you?
Well, for me, I mean, it's nightmares. It's getting uncontrollable rage sometimes. I get mad beyond compare.
What happens to make you mad?
You know, it's funny because it's the littlest things, and it's things that would never have set me off before. It's not every day. Like, I consider myself a high-functioning individual, but there are moments where I stop and I go, what am I doing? You know, where did this come from? I would never have done this before. And it's... I could sit here and we all could sit here and we're soldiers. We take responsibilities for who we are and what we've become. And it's not just the experience that we had over there, but you have to understand yourself. And I get so frustrated because I lost a lot of really good friends because of some of the things that I did. And I did not know that I was doing it at the time. I just wasn't even aware of how bad they were, just saying things that were completely insensitive to people because, if it doesn't kill you, I didn't think it really mattered.
You now are finishing your law degree. You worked on Tammy Duckworth's campaign. You had considered working in politics, but are you still interested in that?
I'm interested in being a voice for people who need a voice. And one of the people who need a voice right now are veterans. And this story needs to be told over and over and over again to anyone who listens because not enough people have intimate personal connections. They haven't served or they don't have family members who have served.
All right, let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Greenville, Texas. Good morning, Greg. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a statement. I wanted to honor, first of all, the veterans that you have on your program and all veterans for that matter. It's hard to believe it's been 37 years since I returned from Vietnam. I was wounded, recovered from my wounds, did not have any after effects. I think that it is shameful that the current administration is cutting funding for head trauma veterans and other veterans and basically the whole Veterans Administration. And I think those kind of actions are unconscionable by our legislators and people in positions of authority in government.
Hold on just one second, Greg. Is that true, Rick, that funds are being cut by this administration?
No, actually, the funding for the VA has gone up dramatically under the Bush administration. That doesn't mean that there's enough money, and I would never tell you that there is enough, but no, the funding's gone up. There has been a fight over money for research of traumatic brain injuries, and that's a matter of how much money do you set aside for the research. And it hasn't been the administration, in fact, that's cut it. It's been Congress that was to blame for the fight over that. And that's been resolved, and been resolved in a fashion so that the full funding will be provided for
that
research.
Oh, good. All right, Greg, I'm sorry to have interrupted you. I just wanted to clarify that. Go right ahead.
Well, you know, I think if you look at some of the bills that have been voted down by the Congress, and, you know, a year ago there was a $2 million, $2 billion emergency appropriation that didn't pass, and a secondary bill after the fact made it $1 billion. So, yeah, maybe that was a technical increase, but, you know, I think VA funding and support for our people that are fighting and dying in Iraq and Afghanistan has been not sufficient. I don't think anybody on your panel there would agree that there's enough money for veterans, and I think we can send our young people to war. Unfortunately, very few of the elected officials in this country have children in that war. It's the middle class that does, and they don't have any problem not taking care of the people that are fighting for our freedom.
Thanks for calling, Greg. We're going to take just a short break. When we come back, you'll hear about the results of the National Symposium for the Needs of Young Veterans, what they feel they need, what they're not getting, and what they should be getting. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. Additional support for NPR comes from the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty, online at hewlett.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a search for 6 of the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust. Daniel Mendelsohn discusses his new book, Lost. It's about investigating what happened to his great-uncle's family. Mendelsohn had discovered letters from the family begging their relatives in the U.S. to help them get out of their Ukrainian town, but they never made it. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Before we go back to the phones, William Betcher, do explain to us the outcome of this National Symposium for the Needs of Young Veterans. I gather most of that is going to be announced tomorrow.
That's correct. Basically, the symposium addressed 4 general areas: benefits, homelessness, health care, and employment. And I guess not so surprisingly to me, because I deal with this day in and day out back home in Cincinnati as a veteran service officer, some of the things that are most troublesome to our returning vets are things that a lot of us have been dealing with for years, such as claims backlog. It takes entirely too much time for a legitimate claim to get through the VA system to where the individual gets his or her disability or pension or so forth. And this is no surprise to the VA, and I've got to say this. The VA and the Department of Labor were very much a part of our, and Department of Defense were very much a part of our symposium and worked as partners in this. This was not an attempt to throw stones at the administration or the VA or anything else. It was an honest attempt for folks to get together and do the right thing by our veterans. And to that end, we very much succeeded. Claims backlog. The simple thing is the Montgomery GI Bill. I mean, those that come back to want to take advantage of their benefit to go to college face sometimes 10 to 13 months before they get an initial payment. It's way too long, and it discourages our young vets from taking advantage of a fine benefit that we already have. Homelessness is a continuing problem. It's reported one out of three homeless persons is a veteran. And homelessness is more than just affordable housing. Mm. PTSD to a degree, a large degree, plays into that. Many of our homeless veterans are veterans from combat zones, Vietnam on up, that experience these problems.
On that very point, here's an email from Laurie in Richfield, Ohio, who says, I dated a Vietnam vet about 20 years ago and could not understand his rage. What is the rage about? Mad that you were sent over? Mad that no one appreciated you? Mad that you're no longer you? But couldn't you be glad you are here and are a stronger version of you? What specifically is it that sets you off? Patrick.
She was looking at me the whole time when she was reading the email. It's something I can't explain. And it's the stupidest things. Like, you know, if I'm running late on something and I'm waiting for someone, you know, I'm losing time or something, all of a sudden I get really mad and then I stop myself and I'm like, wait a second, this isn't me. And so I think I have a pretty good handle on it. But there are times where I'll go 30 seconds where I'll just get so mad I'll get quiet because that's how I become mad. And it's nothing I can explain. And for me, I think it's a lot of times when I was overseas, we get shot at, we get blown up, and there was nothing we could do about it. You know, there was no release. You couldn't fire back. I mean, usually you're driving down the road, a bomb goes off, and you're looking around, and the person's not going to be standing right next to the road with the trigger. And here you see some people dying, and, you know, my responsibility is to save their lives. And then afterwards, I'm like, I want to fight back. I want to be in a war where, you know, they're wearing uniforms and we're wearing uniforms and at least know who I'm shooting is the right people, as opposed to driving down the road and some car gets too close and they fire 30 rounds into it and you kill three innocent civilians. And, you know, they're just a casual, it was us versus them, but it didn't need to be an us versus them. And that anger, you have to sit on it while you're there, because That's what you're doing there. You're there to fight a war, and there are going to be casualties, and you're going to be responsible for those casualties.
Rick.
The research on PTSD kind of shows it's two issues that are really interrelated. One of them is control. You don't feel like you have control. And the second one's helplessness. And they're really sort of interrelated. You're just in a situation, not unlike you were in combat, where you feel like you don't have control of what's happening. You're kind of helpless, and it's more out of frustration than anything else. You can't control what the outcome of anything's going to be. If it's the driver's pulling in front of you, or it's your girlfriend put the glass of water in the wrong place, it can be any small thing, I think. And it's just the research shows us those two things. I mean, it's probably much more complicated than that. I'm boiling it down too easily.
Let's take a caller in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning. I was calling for information. My son has just gone to boot camp, and he wants to jump out of airplanes. And my husband is in the Navy, and he is just gone to Texas to train to go to Iraq. What What do I do? How am I ready for them to come home? What do I read?
Everything. Everything. Take in every bit of information you can find. Contact your local bases. See if they have any support groups. Read everything. Watch every show.
Talk with other people.
Yeah, talk with other people that are in the same situation. And when they come home, realize that they're going to be a little bit different.
How are you different, Shoshana?
I do have anger issues. When they were talking about helplessness and things like that, you know, I think when we were kept in captivity, ours is 10 times worse. They control when you go to the bathroom, when you eat, everything. So I do deal with some anger issues. I think I am a more grateful person just to be here.
How did they treat you while you were in captivity?
I was treated very humanely. I don't get angry at my treatment at all.
Were there men who were also taken captive at the same time?
Yes.
Were they treated any differently?
I don't know. I was isolated from them during most of my captivity.
And you never talked with them afterwards?
Oh, yeah. Actually, one of them's here with me this afternoon.
But you don't know how they...
They tell me a little bit. They will not tell me everything that happened to them. Only they and the debriefers know everything that happened to them.
Bill Betcher.
Yeah, that last call is very interesting. One of the things that came through loud and clear at the symposium was that none of us, the Veterans Service Organizations, the Department of Veterans Affairs, DOD, are doing a good enough job in communicating to the families of our veterans, of our folks, in young folks in the military, about what it's all about. And that came through many of our different groups, and we're all going to have to start doing a better job of that. If we're going to really help our veterans when they come home, their families, their significant others, their mothers and fathers
have to be educated.
To be educated, exactly.
But there are family checklists that they could have that'll show actually signs of PTSD. And in fact, families are one of the first people to report when you're having problems.
They're the ones that push me. So,
yeah. And it's more than
just... the ones that push me. I would have never recognized any of it. And I kept on saying, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm good to go.
And it's more than just PTSD. Someone that had a broken arm in the service needs to know that they need to follow up on that. It may be nothing now at 21 years old when you get out, but that could cause problems for you when you're 50s,
here's,
your 60s.
So, here's an email from Hartmut in Margate, Florida, who says, with all due respect, when we returned from Vietnam, we wanted nothing more than to return to civilian life as soon as possible. This group of veterans should consider themselves lucky to not have to put up with being called baby killers and employers turning them away because of being unstable. Where were these veteran advocates when the Vietnam War ended? And Bill Betcher, we know
as a Marine Vietnam vet myself, I made a promise to myself that I was not going to let that happen to anyone following me. And we're out there, and we're trying to do it. And yes, it's a shame what happened to us, but I can't spend the rest of my life feeling bad about the way I was treated. I have an obligation, I feel, to make a difference in the lives of these young veterans, and that's what we're all about.
And here is a family where apparently you could make a difference. This is from Catherine in Ohio. She says, I've worked with a young veteran who returned in late September of 2003 after fighting in Bosnia, Afghanistan, and then Iraq. He was 23 when he came home to a wife and 18-month-old son. He finally received total disability this past summer in August of 2006 for PTSD. Why is it taking so long for him to get help? What is the military and VA not checking up on how these vets are doing when they come home, Patrick?
He's lucky. That's not a short period of time.
Why is it taking so long? That's the question.
It takes a long time for the VA to process these claims, and they have a huge backlog. And if you can't prove beyond a medical doubt to the regional officer at your local VA hospital, you're not going to get your claim approved. And, you know, you have all these people, especially with post-traumatic stress disorder, they're afraid that, you know, it's just going to be some bogus claim so they can live off the government. But the problem is people are suffering. And when you're suffering, you don't have time to wait for some regional officer to get a clue. And we have to get the VA up, because right now we're turning away people at the vet centers for counseling.
Let's go to Fairport, New York. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Good morning. I would just like to say that there are two bills currently languishing, one in the House and one in the Senate, both to fully fund veterans' medical benefits. The Veterans Administration medical part goes hat in hand, just like the bridge to nowhere in Alaska, through the budget process every year. You know, it's really easy to put that little yellow ribbon on the back of your car and say, we support our troops. Well, you know what? The troops turn into vets. And with 500,000 returning veterans from Iraq, as many as half of them will suffer for some form of PTSD along the way. Maybe not now, maybe not 5 years from now, but it's going to be down the road. It's going to cost money. And you know what? That's part of waging war.
Keith, thanks for your call. Rick Mays, what about those two bills?
Well, there are bills that would make it guaranteed funding for the VA to cover the costs. But I don't think in the short term that funding is the problem. I think that already all people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan are granted 2 years of VA medical care, even without deciding the disability. They have treatment available to them right now. The mandatory funding that he's talking about is for health care only benefits, and health care is not the problem. The payment of benefits is a different problem, and it is a good question why the VA has so many people that they say have PTSD-like syndrome but have never really finished the diagnosis to say that they have it, and that delay in making a final diagnosis is costing them benefits money along the way.
Well, is it also that the VA simply does not have sufficient employees to deal with these returning vets? Is that the issue, or is the issue that they are deliberately moving slowly?
I think the diagnosis is hard to make. It's not an easy yes or no kind of question, and that's part of the reason, because I think that they're reluctant to do that. Now, certainly more employees would help, but it's not a simple matter of they see you and when 10 minutes they can decide that you have PTSD.
Indeed. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. I have a comment that I'd like them to address if they can. I'm a veteran of Bosnia, and I'm still in the Army Reserves, and I was actually activated for the operation, but I wasn't sent overseas. I was a trainer here in the United States. But one of the things that happens in the reserves units is a lot of times they're sent back to their own unit here in the United States, and they remain in the reserves, and it's very hard for them to get to a VA hospital, and they're not offered a lot of the resources that a lot of the active duty soldiers that receive, and they don't get as much support. So I'm just trying to find out how is that being addressed, and if they can address that and find out how I can get help for some of the people in my unit that need help now. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
Bill.
That is one of the issues that we established at the symposium. And here again, it's going to take a good look at what the VA is doing and where they're at. You know, the VA is the largest health care provider in the world. And they've got things underway right now that are making a difference in many areas, maybe not this caller's area, but they're going to outpatient clinics, for example, to capture individuals and not having to come to the main hospital. So this is widening the area that has access for our veterans.
All right, and final question from James in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to express my appreciation to the troops for their service, and I wanted to ask them, the veterans of the current conflict, irrespective of that service, did you ever feel the need to question, beyond just saying we've been asked by our country to do this job, did you ever feel the need to question the validity of our involvement in the region?
Patrick.
I'm laughing because I didn't think we should have been there in the first place, but I volunteered to go to bring people home as a medic. So, I mean, my job as a soldier is to do what I'm told. my job, my overall arching job is and responsibility is to my fellow soldiers. And you know, when I take off that uniform, I get to vote however I want. So I didn't think we should have been there, but I think once we were there, we need to take responsibility for it.
I don't dwell on it. It's no point at this matter. I can't go back and change what is. I can't give me back my 22 days, give me back my legs, and giving me back those 11 people. The point now is how do we come home safely? How do we make sure that when we do come home, our veterans are taken care of? I think we need to let go how we got there and concentrate on how we're going to get out.
Well, that's for the next Congress to decide, isn't it? Well, I want to thank you all so much for your service, for your honor, and certainly for being here. Shoshona Johnson, retired specialist from the U.S. Army, America's first black female prisoner of war in Iraq in 2003. Patrick Campbell, sergeant in the D.C. National Guard. Rick Mays, Times News Service staff writer. And William Betcher, co-chair of the National Symposium for the Needs of Young Veterans. Thank you again, and thanks for listening, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Ann Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Elizabeth Terry. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at Acura.com.